science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Hello, Ellen.
Good afternoon, Lillian.
How's it going?
It's going. It's going off, really. I mean, there's students everywhere, all over the show.
It's very busy, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. That means lectures next week, doesn't it?
It is starting. I feel strange to me beginning at the end of a month, so it seemed in my head, I'm like, oh, yeah, it starts in March. But it's next week.
It is next week, and all of those things I was going to get done over the break, you know, because we've got this enormous long break, supposedly, and yeah, didn't do a thing.
Not quite so long. Can we mention that you may have shifted some timetables? To stick to this? Is that allowed?
I was timetabled for a 12 o'clock Wednesday lecture at AUT, so I said, nah, can't do it, got BFM to do.
Woo-hoo!
So we've changed the lecture time. There we go.
That's amazing. Sorry, students.
Are you listening, Will?
Sorry, students. But they could listen to this and learn some things.
Indeed.
All right, but first up, Picasso. Tell us about this first.
Okay, so I'm not really an arty kind of guy. I know what I like and all of that sort of stuff. And so what is sometimes found is that artworks or famous artworks have been painted over other things. So I think sort of the great example of that supposedly is the Mona Lisa, which people think that it might have been painted over something else or different versions of it or something like that.
Really?
Really?
I didn't know that.
I'm pretty sure. Pretty sure. And so what people have done very, very recently, they've been looking at one of Picasso's works, and it's called The Crouching Beggar, or in the original French, La Miséreuse Accroupie.
Wow.
And this was from his Blue period and was painted in 1902. And this is currently hanging in Ontario in Canada somewhere. And people have been looking at this for about sort of 15 or so years, thinking, there might be something underneath this, because apparently sort of the texture of the paint didn't match up and stuff and blah, 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 blah. And there were little cracks in the paint and they could see sort of other colours through the cracks.
So this is actually something they've been trying to figure out for a while.
Yeah, indeed. And so they now have figured it out, and they figured it out through the magic of X-rays.
X-rays.
And you thought X-rays were only useful for broken bones and things like that.
I never thought that.
But they've got far greater uses than that. And so what they did is to use X-rays and a technique called X-ray fluorescence to figure out that there was actually a picture underneath one of Picasso's more famous pictures. And so they could actually visualize the picture by basically taking an X-ray of the canvas, and it's a scene in Barcelona. It's sort of a landscape of a famous place in Barcelona, and Picasso has painted over this, and he's actually used some of the contours of the landscape to make the beggar's hood or whatever. So she's wearing this big sort of shroud sort of thing, and you can see from underneath it that what was sort of once a hill has now been sort of turned into the shroud, which is kind of cool.
And is it, though? Is this not, like, overriding someone's work?
Well, apparently the reason that he's thought to have done this is because he was a bit poor at that stage of his life. You know, struggling artist, you know? The cliché.
Yes, yes.
And so that's supposedly what he thought, or what someone thought happened. So nobody knows who actually painted the original canvas. They know it's not a Picasso, but they don't know who did it. And they've also sort of analysed a couple of other Picassos as well, and they found that he had reused canvases. So in those cases, he had probably painted the paintings underneath and then painted over them. So, you know, typical struggling artist, you know, Parisian garret, all that sort of stuff.
And, but the person who painted the other one.
Yep.
Did Picasso have permission?
Well, again, you know, he probably just sort of picked it up for a song somewhere from another struggling artist.
But so do you think that, I mean, yeah, I guess we don't know what he was thinking, but was the intention the whole time to use it as a shape that you know, he could draw over?
That's a very good question. You have to ask Picasso, okay. And he's long gone on that one.
I'll make a note of that.
But I was going to talk about sort of the X-ray fluorescence.
Yeah, sorry, we should talk about the science of it,
you know,
actually.
Bugger the art, you know.
But, one of my questions was, though, yeah, like how did they get the idea to X-ray it in the first place?
Because it's well known that you can use X-rays, obviously, to see through things. And the way that this all works is that different matter absorbs X-rays differently, okay? So when we get an X-ray of a arm, or, you know, chest X-ray or something like that, what happens mostly is that all of the soft tissue, the X-rays go through, and all of the bones and stuff like that, the X-rays get absorbed. And so when you've got a photographic plate on the other side of that, you see where it's been absorbed and you see where it goes through. So that's the situation behind just basically taking the X-ray of the actual canvas itself. And the beauty of this is obviously that it's non-destructive. Okay, you don't want to go chipping away at things. And there are other techniques that you can use, but they are kind of destructive. They rely on you taking a little fleck of paint or whatever off the canvas, and that's a destructive technique. So now they've got these cool sort of handheld spectrometers where you can actually do this sort of relatively straightforwardly. And, you know, it's going to be a very big, I guess, technique in sort of the art world in years to come, just to see what is possibly lying underneath famous paintings, you know.
Right.
And the one thing that really clinched it was that they did this technique called X-ray fluorescence. And this is specific to particular elements. So particular elements react to X-rays in a particular way, okay, and that's totally distinct from all the other elements on the periodic table. And so they did this, they shot it with X-rays, and they analyzed this, and they found that there were certainly two layers of paint there, and that elements present in one layer of the paint weren't present in the other layer. So that's the way they figured out there were two layers of paint there, and that they're obviously different, they're using different pigments, blah, 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 and they're painted by different people. So it really is kind of cool. It's a really, really neat thing. And it'd be a very, very cool field to get into, I reckon.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds fascinating. And in fact, there's a Kiwi guy is very, very big in this whole field. His name's Robin Clark. And he'd done a lot of work on this sort of stuff in sort of the 70s, 80s, 90s, using another technique that was sort of slightly destructive, which, you know, relied on taking little flecks of paint off and stuff like that. But he was certainly very big in that field, so it's really nice.
There's definitely no damage from the X-ray on the painting?
No. So, yeah.
Amazing.
Kind of cool.
Very cool.
Yeah.
What will we find?
Yes.
I like that I say we as though I'm involved. Okay.
But I said I'm not arty, but... what was it? I was in New York, and the portrait of Sir Thomas More by Holbein, younger or older or whatever, the most amazing painting. You just stand and look at it. It was painted in 1400 and something or whatever. It's just utterly, utterly, utterly astonishing.
That's your favourite?
Takes your breath away. That, and there was a Hieronymus Bosch thing as well that could have been painted yesterday, but again was painted in the 1400 or 1500s or something. And shit, just seeing that in the flesh. Yeah,
very,
very
cool.
Very cool. You can see why people like art.
Mm, yes. Yeah. Next topic. Arthrum?
Arthrum.
Is that how you say it?
Arthrum. Well, I'm assuming it is.
Okay.
But this made the news last week, in the Herald and stuff and places like that. And so MedSafe had sort of brought this to the attention of the wider public, I guess. So this is a herbal dietary supplement, quote unquote. And just having a look at their website, what it's used for is to, quote, maintain and support joint health and mobility, and other, quote, for maintenance and support of healthy joints. Okay, now you can read that last one in two ways.
Yeah.
If you've got healthy joints, then they're going to stay healthy, you know, so what's the bloody point? And my mantra, anything where they say helps support whatever, just avoid it like the plague.
Why?
Okay, because it means nothing. Helps support healthy living. Water helps support healthy living, for God's sake, you know. And these things are dietary supplements for a reason, and that reason being that they don't necessarily have to disclose the contents of them, and they don't have to prove that they're safe, okay? Now, the problem with this stuff is that 14
they
people...
They don't?
No, they don't. Dietary supplements.
Like protein?
Yeah, like anything like that. You can sell any old bloody thing.
And it probably doesn't
And it doesn't have to go through any sort of clinical process or anything like that, and you can sell anything as being a dietary supplement, okay? And way back when they were selling... Oh, no, I won't go there. Anyway, so the problem with this stuff is that 14 people had severe liver problems after taking this stuff. So hepatitis and jaundice, okay?
What?
Nothing to be sneezed at. So...
how long have they been taking them?
Not sure.
Okay.
Not sure. But MedSafe said, right, okay, so, you know, this isn't good. We can't do this.
Yeah.
And so that's good. So Metzlaff sort of caught up with them and everything like that, which is, you know, I think is a good thing. However, again, reading the story, and it said that the chemical composition of the extract that they used to make this stuff from is not disclosed. Okay, so basically what they're saying is they don't know what's in it. Or if they do know what's in it, they're not telling us.
That's and the company?
Yeah. Okay. And that's dangerous. That's just ridiculous. Very. But it's within the law because they sell it as a dietary supplement.
Wow.
So, you know, beware.
Yeah, how do we find out, though? How do you research this stuff?
That's a very good question. Now, again, looking at their website, it's not overly informative, but what it does say is that it's been a component of Chinese medicine for the last 2,000 years. Now, I'm not against Chinese medicine. I mean, there, and I'm certainly not against herbs and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, for goodness sake, aspirin was developed from willow bark, and that had been known for, you know, 2,000-3,000 years, that you get willow bark, you boil it up in water, you drink it, and your fever goes down. You know, that's knowledge from the ancients, really. And there's a whole host of current drugs that are sourced from so-called natural, you know, products, so plants, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But you can't just go willy-nilly bloody boiling anything up and then selling it as a herbal natural extract because, shit, it can kill you, you know. There are very, very dangerous plants out there, you know, tutu, you boil that up and drink that, you'll be, you know.
Not well.
Not well, indeed. Right. So I think really the law needs to be looked at here. It really, really does, because it's an enormous loophole, the fact that you can get away with selling these things
as a dietary supplement.
And just be very, very careful to not make any therapeutic claims about them. And that's why they always say helps support whatever. Because that's not a
therapeutic. There's no conclusive.
Right. That's not a therapeutic claim. You're not saying that it'll cure this or anything like that. You just say, oh, it helps support healthy joints. Which is utterly bollocks.
So you're just spending money on
yep.
nothing.
Yep, yep. So if they're really serious about this, and they say it's gone through clinical trials and everything, then put it through
prove
real...
It.
Yeah, prove it.
Yeah.
You know, the onus is on the sellers here,
yeah.
on the vendors, not the bloody people who are buying it. Mm. And shit, if you're going to end up with, you know, liver damage because of taking the stuff, it's not good. Having said that, every drug, clinically approved or not, has got side effects.
Yes.
It does, okay? Every bloody drug. And you never know whether you're going to have those side effects or not. However, at least we know what those side effects are, those possible side effects. And at the first sign of any, you know, danger, you stop taking it. But these things here...
Right, so it's not even actually put a disclaimer out saying you might get liver damage.
I do notice on the website now that it says, you know, should not take this if you've had any liver problems and stuff like that. So, yeah, politicians, if you're listening, can we please do something about this?
Politicians always listen to BFM.
Absolutely.
Obviously. Something's going to happen. All right, Will, Will is joining us in the studio now. Hey, Will.
Hi.
All right, Will. You're here for the last topic.
I had to come in for something.
Made it. What's our final story,
Well, Ellen? Unfortunately, it's a very visual story, unfortunately. So your listeners may have to go to a website or something like this to get the whole brilliance of this, really. So how small is an atom, folks?
Very, very small.
Okay, very, very small. You're absolutely right.
Way too small to see with the bare eye.
Absolutely. Yes, it is. So they're tiny things. 10 to the minus 10 of a meter sort of radius, something like that, or diameter. Far, far too small to see with the naked eye. So it may surprise you to notice that, or to note, that a student at Oxford University won a science photograph competition very recently by taking a photograph of a single atom with a normal bog standard common or garden camera.
Wow.
Yeah, wow indeed. Okay, and that is seriously cool. And if you look up the photo of it, if you go to qz.com and search for the name Nadlinger, David Nadlinger, because he's the guy that did it, then you'll see this amazing photo of this little purple dot sort of suspended in space.
And it's kind of lit up, looked like.
Yep. And that's the thing. It's lit up. Well said. That segues perfectly into the explanation of how you can possibly see something that's too small to see. And the reason that you can do that is because the single atom, and it's an atom of the element strontium, and it's suspended in a thing called an ion chamber.
Why strontium? Sorry, before you...
Because it works. I guess, or that just happened to be the element that they were studying that particular day.
Okay, so there's not really a specific reason.
It's probably something to do with its actual mass or something like that, and it just you can easily suspend these things in ion chambers.
Oh, okay.
And what they do is they shoot a laser at it. It absorbs some of that laser light, and then what it then does is that it actually starts glowing, essentially. It starts giving out light, okay? So it absorbs energy from the laser beam and then it starts giving out light. And because it's sort of perfectly stationary in this, if you do a big time exposure and just have it going for long enough, it absorbs, it emits, it absorbs, it emits, it blah, 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 blah. And eventually what he got was this little purple dot.
Wow.
Of this so single atom.
When I saw the photo, I thought maybe the laser is reflecting off.
No, it's
actually absorbing the energy or the light.
Yep. So it's got to be of a particular, and that'll be why they chose strontium, actually thinking, because it'll be absorbing particular energy, which it's got to do. Okay, so they'll be using a laser of a particular color, particular energy, etc., etc.
And the circle you see isn't actually as big as the atom is. It's the light.
Yeah, it's what you're seeing is the light that's emitted by the atom. You're not actually seeing the atom itself. You're seeing the light that's emitted by the atom.
But it allows you to distinguish it, basically.
Yep.
Sort of like when you look at the sun in a way, because you're seeing the light of the sun. You're not seeing.
Well, we're not looking directly at the sun.
We do not endorse looking at the sun at BFM. But like, you see a larger thing if you were to look at it with glasses or something.
Yeah.
We do like the sun's energy, though.
We do. We are all solar powered. Earth is solar powered.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so this tiny, tiny, tiny little thing, the photograph competition. And you know, not so long ago it was thought that it would be impossible to actually visualize individual atoms, and nowadays it's totally commonplace. And what they particularly use these things for, sort of imaging biological molecules like cells and stuff like that, is that they sort of incorporate these little, what they call fluorescent atoms or molecules or whatever, into cells, and then they hit them with a particular colored light, and then these things start glowing back at you. And there's been a couple of Nobel Prizes in the past 5-10 years that have been awarded for these types of techniques. And one of the things they actually got out of jellyfishes, because you know all about bioluminescence, you go to the sea and you see it at night, it sometimes glows blue and stuff like that. So that's the same basis of all of this sort of stuff. And they extracted a protein from jellyfish called green fluorescent protein, very imaginatively named. And then they can get all the little bugs to express this particular protein and stuff like that, and it fluoresces green, and so you can tell wherever it's in there. And you know, it's really, really, really clever stuff. But photographing
very
a single atom with a normal camera.
Is that the first time you've seen an atom?
No, because it depends what you mean by see.
Well, have you seen one in real life? Like, have you had the tools to isolate the atom?
I have seen. Yeah, I have quote unquote seen. Now they've got these things called scanning tunneling microscopes, okay, and they work exactly the same way that vinyl works. So a record, okay, so a record works because you've got a needle and it goes in a groove, okay, and it's going up and down in that groove and converting that to sort of audible noise. You do the same thing with a scanning tunneling microscope, except your needle is of atomic dimensions. It's tiny, tiny, tiny. And what you're doing is you're dragging it over a surface, and so it's going up and down, tiny, tiny amounts. And you can magnify that, and then you can get an image of the surface, or you can get image of the individual atoms on a surface and stuff like that, just using essentially the same sort of technology that you use for playing a record, which is,
Very cool.
It's amazing. All the stuff out there just, you know, blows your mind.
Could talk about it for the whole hour, but we have to wrap up.
But we can't.
That should be the stinger. That should be the ending thing. All right, well, thank you, Alan.
Okay, always a pleasure.
We do have to disclaim that we do not have a wire next week, so you get a break.
Oh, no.
I'm very sorry.
No wire next week.
No.
We are broadcasting
really important
from the King's Arms, which it's its final day of being open.
Goodness
me. So it's last day. So there's a whole broadcast from the King's Arm that's that day, so we don't have a why.
So science isn't good enough for the King's Arm, is what you're saying.
Well, you can
we could show up. We could just show up and we could just
the
take over the mic.
Beer. There we go. You know.
Well, let's stay in touch on that, eh? Let's do that.
I vote yes to that.
I vote yes as well.
That was Dear Science.